Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and guests.
So welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. We're at episode 177. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm CB Woodhouse.
And I'm Wal Reed.
Welcome along. Good to have you both here.
Cheers, Paul. CB.
Thanks for inviting us.
Now, just to for those that don't know where either of you sit in, CB, where do you fit within the New Zealand technology community?
So I guess I'm most famous for being the founder and former owner of Orcon, which I sold a few years ago, and now I'm running an internet company called Voyager, and we host about a quarter of all New Zealand's websites and domains. So,
Great. Well, thanks for coming back.
My name's Wal. I am an avid tech geek and also run the New Zealand Entertainment Podcast as well. Host that show.
Excellent. All right, well, let's jump in now. First up, local story yesterday, ASB announced what they're calling ASB PayTag. Now, over the last sort of 12, 24 months, we've looked at a range of payment systems that sort of are based from your smartphone. Predominantly this sort of Android-based near-field communications technology, which of course is the same technology that's on most of the newer credit cards today, in terms of MasterCard and Visa with their sort of tap-to-pay type capability. That's at most of the supermarkets now, a lot of gas stations. And there have been variations on that technology that's been trialled in smartphones here in New Zealand. Nothing commercially available other than an offering between 2Degrees and Snapper, which is really focused on the Wellington market, where you can get a special SIM card that allows you to do your payments and so on that way.
Yeah.
But ASB have just announced their new thing, which they're calling PayTag. Now, I understand this sort of thing's been done overseas, and all it really does, from what I can understand, is it takes that little chip, the near-field communications piece that's in your credit card, and they turn that into a sticker that you can attach to your smartphone. So instead of carrying around your credit card, you just attach that to your smartphone, because you probably take your smartphone with you wherever you go, and you can use that to do your transaction. What are your thoughts on this? Is this a massive innovation?
It's a little bit gimmicky, but I must say, for various reasons, I'm a member of pretty much every single bank, and therefore I have all of the banking apps, and I always notice that despite ASB not being my current main bank, they always have the best iPhone app. You can pay your Facebook friend, you can do instant transfers, there's features that no one else has, so I trust
ASB
to be a leader.
I think it was BNZ actually that did the Trade Me payment thing first,
right?
But there you go, just dropping that in there, because I know I first heard about ASB with some of these things, but then later sometimes I find out, oh, actually someone else did that first, but they just didn't make a noise about it, and we didn't know. ASB, I think, are very good at telling the story of that they're first, but I mean that looks like they're first on this.
Well, let's just remember, it is only a sticker. It's a cashless, touchless sticker that goes on your phone. I mean, first we had tap and gap, tap and go, and now we've got tap the phone. I mean,
it's the same technology.
It's just a step towards being cashless.
But the service was hacked in Germany. So basically, there was a guy wandering around with a backpack with an amplified tap and go terminal, basically sucking up everyone's tap and go, taking $80 off every single person. So I think we need to be aware that if there's someone with a compromised terminal sitting in a backpack, it's not entirely safe. And Visa sort of said, oh, it's 100% safe, but
I guess the point is that they back it up with their guarantee that they'll cover those transactions. And you imagine if someone does have a dodgy terminal or doing lots of false transactions, it's going to be pretty hard for them to pull that money out, because people are going to report it reasonably quickly, and whoever's got that dodgy terminal is not being able to get the funds
think that, but at the end of the day, it doesn't stop a lot of Visa, MasterCard credit fraud happening.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, that has to be done through some merchant. So if you're going to rip someone's Visa card off and have a stolen number, you have to do it somewhere.
And also, kids, today are going to be, instead of being stepped out for your boots or your shoes, you're going to be stepped out for your sticker. I mean, what's going to happen? You'd be sticker transferring, illegal sticker transferring.
Let alone the smartphone it's attached to. We won't worry about that.
Well, I actually did find one of these cards. I think it was an ASB one a little while back. I'd just flown in from somewhere, and it was, you know, some strange hour, and, you know, went off to get something, a drink or whatever at the gas station on the way home, and as I walked out, there sitting on the floor, or on the ground, was, you know, one of these cards. But, you know, it's not the sort of thing you pick it up and you think, oh, that's cash, spend it. There's a little bit more of a, oh, yeah, this is sort of electronic. And so, you know, I'm not saying that I wouldn't have returned the cash if there had been a way to do so, but certainly with a card, it was, yeah, it's much, you know, you feel a little bit different about it than picking up, you know, cash.
Well, maybe the best solution is to have one of these little stickers, but to stick it on one of the back of these waterproof Galaxy Gear watches we're going to talk about later. And then you've got your cash with you, you've got your watch, you don't need a phone, it's all waterproof, and don't need your keys if you've got a Bluetooth capable car. And
well, I guess that's totally possible. So so the general consensus pay tag from ASB. Now, I think they're launching it with their Visa debit card. So
I'm going to get one, you guys. Yeah, I'm definitely going to get one. I'm all for a cashless society, the sticker of the beast and all that, definitely.
I guess if it gives you the flexibility to stick it on your key fob, stick it on your watch, stick it on your phone, it makes things easier, then it's a good innovation.
Very cool.
Yep. So I mean, and definitely one thing I like is just the fact that our banks in New Zealand are, you know, trying to step it up and compete with each other, you know, whether it's trying to come up with some you know, smart use of Google Glass, which, you know, isn't even here yet, but, you know, that's being played around with, or, you know, apps that work in different ways. I think, you know, I'm all for there being a, you know, competition here and changing the old banking world for one that's doing good stuff. So.
Well, one of the things that a lot of Kiwis don't realise, if they even some that have travelled widely, is that, you know, New Zealand was first to implement FBOSS, and we're so far ahead of the rest of the world.
Right,
I have a subsidiary company in the US, and just doing banking is so hard. And if you ask for someone's bank account number so you can pay to them, you might get a punch in the face because they think you're going to rip them off or something. So you have to do, you know, three week checks that take, you know, weeks to clear, and then even then it's not guaranteed, and it's really, really hard banking in the US, and you just don't sort of appreciate actually how far ahead New Zealand is.
And it's very simple here because we have so few banks as well, and it's, you know, so quick and easy to transfer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think most Kiwis will pick up on this new technology. We love all the new gadgets and doodadkeries and what have you. I think there's one way that's going to, yeah, people will get to tap into it.
Good. Now, looking at Android phones, which has been one of the spaces where we've seen some innovation around, you know, electronic payments and so on. But last week, of course, was the Galaxy S5, which we've got here. Been playing with that a little bit over the last few days, and it is really the flagship, you know, the top phone, I guess, of the moment in terms of what's available globally. Samsung have gone with the global launch, you know, same day in many, many countries around the world. Certainly something that, in general, manufacturers haven't been very, very good at. Apple certainly have been improving in those regards, although, you know, New Zealand has, you know, recently with it, certainly I think the iPhone 5S, you know, I think we sat back a little bit from rest of the world, some of the other, you know, launches. But, Samsung have worked really hard to have that sort of simultaneous global launch. And it's a pretty impressive phone in many regards. CB, is this the first time you've had a good sort of look at it?
Yeah, so I had I was away for 4 months last year, and I had a Samsung S4 in the US, and it's basically the same form factor, but got a fingerprint scanner, a heart rate monitor, and it's supposed to be semi-waterproof. But the screen, to me, looks pretty identical. But it's very, you know, it is very nice. It's very crisp and clear, and obviously quite snappy with the quad-core processor and everything that it's got.
And we've been playing around with the wearables that Samsung have launched with it. And I think this is actually really smart that they've launched them all together as sort of, you know, this combined experience of, you know, it's not just this phone that operates independently. It's the Gear Fit. If, you know, if you want just that sporty device with its wide or its long touchscreen, and then the, you know, the Gear 2 and the Gear 2 Neo. So, you know, touching a lot of bases there in terms of what people might want to wear, because certainly that the wearables of sort of fitness devices, that has been starting to grow probably quicker than the smartwatch category itself. So having something that sort of sits in between with the Gear Fit, I think makes some sense. And there are people that are sort of looking at the wearables and saying, oh, I quite like this, and you know, that's likely to push them into buying a Samsung phone as well.
Yeah, the Gear Fit, this is the first time I've seen this device. I think there's something my girlfriend would really, really like. It's slim, it's got a really nice colour screen, it's got a lot of functions, it's got a heart rate monitor. So me and my girlfriend played around with Fitbit for a while, but it's got no screen, so it's fairly limited, and you've got to wear this thing on your wrist. But this is you know, really nice looking, really nicely designed, and it's a lot less bulky than the Galaxy Gear with the, you know, camera and the Gear 2 that's quite bulky. But this is actually something that I think a girl would really like to wear.
You wouldn't wear it South Sea?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it's quite feminine, but I mean it's a very nice device, and you know, it's got you know, remote control for your sound, it's got a heart rate monitor, it's got exercise, it's got a pedometer, it's got a beautiful colour screen. It looks attractive, looks like a nice bracelet, doesn't look like a big bulky smartwatch. You know, the Galaxy Gear, I think, for a girl is a bit sort of, you know, masculine.
Yeah, yeah.
In my mind. Yeah.
Do you like the look of the watch?
Yeah, the Gear 2's, you know, an improvement on the Gear 1, and an iterative improvement. Being an Apple fanboy, I've actually got a Pebble, and I've been trialling that the last couple of weeks, and I have found that it's actually really useful to get a text message and just glance at your wrist if you're in a meeting or something, rather than pulling out your phone and then, you know, sort of doing that thing of you know, getting back. So I've found the Pebble useful, but it's a lot more limited than the Samsung devices with the colour screens and that kind of thing.
I actually think the Samsung S5 is actually a marketing nightmare for dyslexics. So what they're trying to do is skew this at towards Apple users, trying to get the share of the market Apple users, and marketing at dyslexic Apple users.
S5, 5S.
That's what it is. That's what it's all. It's a conspiracy theory there.
Yeah.
All right. But I like the new.
Thanks for that observation.
That's okay, mate. It was for free. But I like the TouchWiz on it. It looks clean. Looks a bit iOS, dare I say it. It's not a metal build case, and I know there's a lot of you know, talk about that. But I actually think, you know, even though it's plastic, it actually looks quite fashionable. But
well, the waterproof element of it, I guess, you know, Sony sort of really pushed that last year with their new Android device, and again this year with the Xperia, you know, Z2, and obviously, you know, tablets that are waterproof as well. And the fact that they're able just to build this in as standard in their standard device, I think there's definitely, you know, something in that. It is a little bit annoying, though, having that sort of, you know, bung or cover at the bottom for the charger. I haven't found that to be
a big deal. Let's throw it in your sink.
Eventually, it's probably going to, you know, some of those are going to break off, or someone's not going to close it properly, and their phone's going to get wet. So,
well, I actually had a friend that was gloating about his Sony Xperia being waterproof and that kind of thing, and then demoed it a few times, and then, oh, hang on, it's not turning on. Killed it in a $1,500 phone.
No.
Dead. So, it doesn't.
Not a good play.
I think water resistance probably, it's more of an insurance policy than a guarantee, I think. But
they are pretty good, though, my experience with that stuff, having tried them out. But they're not designed for underwater photography and the like. That, you know, that's not the game.
No?
Okay. But in terms of having that dustproof and waterproofness, they're reasonably capable.
Well, I think it's a necessary improvement with the number of phones that get dropped in the toilet out of your top pocket and things. You don't want it to be instantly dead. So it's just that one time you actually do it. And
Well, there's that small number of things of where a phone devalues to next to nothing, and it's when you crack the screen, and you know, often it's just too much hassle for people to, you know, get the screen fixed, or it's an expensive, you know, hassle to jump through those hoops, and getting your phone wet, you know, is the other one, sort of, you know, breakage and that water damage. So I think it's good. Now, a phone that doesn't go with waterproof is the new HTC, and you know, they've sort of followed on from the style. They started the sort of the all-in-one style with the HTC One X going back a couple of years ago. We've got one of those sort of sitting here in its white look, and that was a reasonably strong design in its time. It had a few issues and wasn't as strong sort of battery life as some of the other phones.
Mm.
And then, you know, last year we saw the HTC One, and now we've got the HTC One and then brackets M8. I'm not quite sure why they've. Well, I'm not sure whether it's mate or M8, but I don't know. The mate just sounds a bit too matey to me. So, but I like that. And I've just had my hands on it probably for the past sort of 6 days. I didn't have it last week for the podcast, but I think I got it the day after.
Yeah.
And you know, it stands up very well, and I think it's great that we don't just have Samsung that are pushing on these larger, you know, form factor phones, the Android phones, that there is a bit of competition there now between you know, Samsung, LG, Sony, and HTC, all doing something that's a little bit different. There are similarities, but CB, you made some comments about this hardware before we started the podcast, referencing back to Apple and so on. What was your comment there?
Yeah, well, we've been doing a bit of talking, so I can't remember exactly what I said, but I'm super impressed with the M8. I think it's a beautiful build quality phone, and you know, HTC was really the first company that followed Apple's sort of industrial design ethic with the aluminium finishes. But I mean, this phone is quite heavy. It actually almost feels more like stainless steel than you know, aluminium to me. It's very, very robust. It feels very, very high quality. Almost feels like you'd beat someone that was attacking you off with it, and it would be completely fine. It's not in the least bit plasticky, and the cover is
it
extremely
looks bulletproof
nice
too.
Well, talking about beating people up with a phone, in the US last year, one of the things that that I saw was a case for the iPhone that turned it into a stun gun. So it had a battery, and it was
hopefully it doesn't use the iPhone's battery, because in half the day you'd be flat. You'd be like, oh, I'm being attacked, damn it, I'm out of battery again.
No, so it was a battery extender for the iPhone, but it also so if you really need to beat somebody up, that's the way to do it. But I wasn't sure about getting back through customs with that,
the stun gun add on.
Yeah, the Moofy stun pack.
scary stuff. And the cover in it's quite unique as well, isn't it? And that's an optional cover. I don't know how much it's going to be here. The phone we know is going to be $1,099, so it's the most expensive, I think, starting point for any smartphone in the market. And they've, you know, I guess that's their thing, is they're going for a real, you know, super premium, you know, top end device in terms of its design and build. It's got the dual cameras on the back, but yeah, the unusual thing being that they're 4-megapixel cameras, which I think there's still a lot of debate around that comparing to everyone else who's gone for higher megapixel. They've gone for lower megapixel, saying they can pull more
light
in.
Why would HTC want to do a 5-megapixel selfie?
Well, yeah, the 5-megapixel on the front, and I've tried that out as well.
And the main camera's only 4-megapixel.
Yeah, I'm not 100% convinced about what they've done with the cameras, but it is quite cool having that dual camera and being able to actually do this thing where you take a shot and then it takes a depth, so it's able to do something with, say there's a picture of, you know, a couple of people in the foreground, and then whatever's in the background, you know, you can black and white that, or you can blur that, and you know, different right, effects so like that can be done quite easily. So I think that's kind of cool.
It's quite strange because it's got three cameras, which is getting insane, but it's got one forward facing camera and it's got two rear cameras. So obviously there's some kind of thing, but yeah, it's a beautiful design quality, and the cover is a sort of high quality rubberized feeling cover, but it's perforated, and you can actually touch the cover as you can the screen, and it shows a sort of large format digital display on the screen through, so you can you can access most of the functions and read text messages and things through the cover, which is quite unique.
It's limited what you can do through the cover, but it is handy. Yeah, you give it the double tap and it, you know, wakes up and so on. You can swipe down from the top, do that gesture, and it turns on the voice control, so you make a call, you hang up your call and so on. So I think that's it's part of the sort of what manufacturers are able to do with Android in terms of that customization to come up with something unique, and you know, that's part of the reason I think, you know, Android has been so successful, is that you know, every manufacturer can really pour an effort in to do something special with it, whereas we look across at, you know, Windows Phone, which is, you know, is trying to edge up there in their market share, and you know, and they are definitely, you know, slowly edging up, but it's very hard for one manufacturer to have something that's a whole lot different to another manufacturer. I've got, you know, the actually Samsung's 8S here, and yeah, it's a really nice phone, and you know, style wise and so on, it's definitely different to what the others are doing. What the others are doing in the market looks very much like a cross between say an S3 and an S4, but you know, software wise. There's not that huge room for doing anything unique. You know,
Paulie, I am going to go out on a limb here and disagree with my esteemed colleague, Mr. Seaband. So I find the display a little bit washy, but I definitely agree that the metal casing gives it a premium look, and something that Samsung probably would probably benefit from doing with their premium flagship.
It does feel nice in the hand, though. The HTC does feel, you know, it does feel nice in the hand. Definitely, it's got a really, nice feel about it. So, and it's got the same as all the other top-end Androids. It's got that remote control, infrared remote control in it for controlling, your TV and your DVR and whatever. One thing that I liked about LG did, and Samsung have done a similar thing with the S5, is having, and again, this is a software customization thing that Android allows you to do, is having that remote control come up on the lock screen, so you can just grab your phone and turn the TV down, or you know, pause something, change channel. The number of controls that are on that lock screen is limited, so it's probably not as flexible as I would like. But that's maybe something else that HTC could have done. You've got to unlock and get in there to do the remote. But
that Apple needs to do better with the Apple TV, don't they? They need to put the Apple TV controls on your actual home screen.
I think that sort of stuff is super handy, just making it really accessible, so you're much more likely to use your smartphone rather than to have to go for the old school look around for the one of many remotes that are wherever they are, whereas you've always got that phone in your pocket. Now jumping on to other new products, curved TV screens. We've talked about these. You know, the CES showed off many of them this year, and had a good look at those up to the the big boys, sort of 105 inch from Samsung and so on. LG also showing off theirs. There's a lot of competition between those two brands. I had a look at a few weeks back. Maybe even in January now. Yeah. I've lost track. Samsung had a few of the sort of prototype or pre-release of those curved TVs they're looking to launch into the New Zealand market. I don't think they've actually formally announced them yet, but there were a couple of things that sort of stood out for me on the Samsung ones. I believe that they're putting in a satellite and a terrestrial tuner into the TV. So in terms of getting Freeview, if you're not in one of the big cities, you've usually needed to have some sort of Freeview set top box to be able to get that satellite, that you hook your satellite dish into, so that you can watch TV. Yeah. Since we've moved to Freeview, so we haven't got the full story on what Samsung's launching yet. But my impression is that they're going to bundle in that satellite capability directly into at least some of the new round of TVs.
Great, because it removes another remote and a whole pain in the ass type thing.
That built in, and the other thing is they've got the DVR, the digital video recorder capability, sort of built in. Not with the hard disk and so on, but it allows you to attach a big USB stick or a hard drive to the TV directly and do that recording again, not having to have a separate box that your Freeview runs through that you record onto it, a TiVo or whatever other sort of box that you've got. I think that's good having that built into the.
That's going to be the big TV. The big growth category is going to be curved and 4K TV. Definitely.
Well, that's what they're saying. I'm interested in sort of seeing how the prices land.
Yeah.
Now both of you have sort of had a look at the curved TVs. And the ones that you've seen so far, how do you rate them compared to flat? Is it really that much better experience from your perspective?
Yeah, so I've seen an LG 85-inch quad HD curved TV in the flesh, and it was super, super impressive. And my understanding, for people that don't know, is that the curve on a TV means that you don't get one angle of reflection. So if there's a big bay window or something behind you, instead of sort of seeing a big you know, reflection of everything. You get a narrow band of the reflection on where you're looking at, but then everything else is super sharp, and that was my experience. But you know, the Quad HD, and this TV had 3D and everything as well. I mean, it was virtually better than real life, you know. It was absolutely so pixel dense. You know, they had a 3D thing of a rainforest, and it was, you know, insanely close to reality. It was really really good.
And I was lucky enough to see the new curved 4K Samsung TV. The big thing was for them was that the upscaling as well is pretty cool, and also the they have a chip in that this year's TVs, 4K TVs, will have a chip that allows it when the service is available in New Zealand for 4K streaming. Video streaming, which has started to take off over in the US.
Right, so you have some flexibility for upgrading.
And the TVs will support that as well.
Right, and that's been part of Samsung's story, hasn't it? Is, you know, rather than buying the screen that suddenly becomes obsolescent in the future, there is, you know, a way to sort of upgrade the smarts inside and go from, you know, one this year's sort of generation to another of those internal smarts. Not particularly cheap to do so, but it's certainly nice to have that option, particularly if you've spent sort of, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10K on one of those screens.
Yeah, we have a Samsung smart TV that's about a year old at work, and the thing that I find extremely frustrating is every single time I turn the TV on to do a presentation or something, it wants to do a software update, and it's doing things, and also the user interface is incredibly slow. So the thing about TV is you normally press a button, it's on, it's instant, it's responsive, you change channel, it's responsive. And so I think in the days of internet television and that kind of thing, that, you know, they've got to nail that TV is an instant medium like radio. There can't be this sort of,
and
you know,
seamless delay. Updates that happen overnight when you're sleeping and so on, so it's just there when you turn it on.
To me, my Samsung TV, I feel like throwing out the window, because it takes me 30 seconds a minute before I can use it at best a lot of the time, and it's just annoying.
You're going to get it curved, aren't you, for work?
Now, so after we record this show, we're LG are doing their launch of their new curved TVs, and so next week we'll be able to sort of report back in terms of, you know, what it is and in terms of their particular story for the New Zealand market. We shared sort of what we loosely know around Samsung. They haven't made a formal announcement or launch yet, so, you know, the information about tuners and so on is just we don't know exactly what's going to be on what products and so on, but hopefully tonight we'll get the picture filled in on LG. But the good thing here is we've got, you know, a couple of parties that are you know, challenging each other, and that's always
my
good
understanding
for the consumer.
All the vendors will be bringing out curved TV this year as well, so it's going to be interesting sell to the public, you know, especially when they had 3D trying to sell that, and now curved TV as well. So I suppose in the end, the people will decide.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, part of it, the mainstream level comes down to pricing, but there's always a premium end of the market, and, you know, that's where these companies make, you know, in theory, make their big bucks, is on those higher end you know, TVs. And I'm looking forward just to how they stack up. The Samsung ones certainly look pretty good from what I've seen, and, you know, so did the LG product too. So
I think the curved innovation sort of instantly makes sense. It's something that they've suddenly thought, hang on, this actually makes less glare, less reflection, it makes sense, done. So you bring it out and it's done. But it's annoying that 3D's been with us for 3 or 4 years, and there's incompatibilities, and glasses don't work, and they got batteries and they go flat. And, you know, I think 3D TV is pretty cool. Of the one that I saw in the shop, it works really, really well. But then you go home, you've got no content, you don't know which glasses to have, your friends can't always watch it. You know, if you've got people sitting off to the side, it doesn't work, and, you know, all those sort of problems. So they need to be solved. But I think 3D will be one of these things that all of a sudden, once the, you know, VHS versus Betamax type stuff's being worked out, then it'll be, you know, really cool, and it'll all of a sudden become really
still
prevalent.
No broadcasting, you know.
Well, I think there has been in some markets, and they've actually stopped doing it, because there hasn't just been that much pickup for it. I mean, I think for it to really work, you've got to have it built in, but you also need that option to be able to turn it off, because there is a level of eye strain associated with it. So, I'm not sure whether we'll ever really have that really broad adoption, but hey, never say never.
At least it's there.
Now, I did mention briefly Windows Phone 8.1. It's on. We saw it last week. Nathan Mercer from Microsoft was in on the NZ Tech podcast and showed us that sort of before its availability. It is now available semi-publicly. And what Microsoft have done here is quite interesting because we look at Android and iOS. They're very different in terms of getting updates. Apple has this huge amount of power with the carriers because everyone will do whatever it takes to be able to sell the iPhone because every carrier needs to, every mobile operator needs to have the iPhone. And of course here in New Zealand, 2Degrees have just, in the last few months recently jumped through those hoops and signed their life away, whatever they've done to be able to sell the iPhone, and we've heard of stories of carriers in the US that have, signed multi-billion dollar sort of commitments with Apple to in terms of selling their product. So there's some hoops to jump through, and as part of that, the mobile companies have to accept then when Apple pushes out a software update, that they don't really get they don't get any say. It just goes out, which is fantastic because everyone gets that access to that latest version. Generally, the large majority of people get it virtually straight away on a global basis, and that's great. At the other end of the scale, we've got Android with such a different mix of versions across phones and how long it takes to get a version, and that HTC One X there, which is 2 years old from HTC, but it's never going to get an official Android 4.4 update. Mm. You want Kit Kat, hey, go to the dairy and buy one to chew on, but look it's not coming to that phone, and that's been one of the frustrations. Microsoft sort of seemed to land in this place in the middle where there are some sort of rules around it, and the manufacturers have to be able to have to come on board, which is basically the phone to get the updates. The carriers, the telecoms and Vodafones and 2Degrees do still have to sign off, so there can be some delays. But the unique thing which Microsoft have done, have said, hey, we've got a developer program which anyone can sign up for free. You install the developer app, put in your credentials, and you have to go through a process to sign up as a developer, and then suddenly you can get access that new version. So if you want to be at the forefront on your Windows phone, anyone anywhere in the world can get it, and it doesn't cost you anything, and you move more to that Apple type experience of getting the new features, notification centers, and all of those other things that they've sort of built in, and it seems to be a really good release. But I think this is this is a good thing from Microsoft that they've realized they can't leave their consumers behind, that they give this early access, whereas it might be 2 months before we see this update became available, from the carriers. Otherwise,
well, I've got something to say about that, but as I said, I've got an S4, which I had as my US phone last year when I was there for a few months. But I also ended up buying a Windows Lumia phone because it was cheaper to buy a Lumia phone to use as a hotspot, a 4G hotspot, than it was to
buy a 4G hotspot.
So my girlfriend and I and our laptops and everything ended up using this device. And the other day it prompted me to update to 8.1 because it's connected to Wi-Fi. It sits in my office. And I quite like the Windows interface. I think the Windows smartphone interfaces, they've gone their own way, they've done something different, and I really want to like it. But I did the update, and then whenever I press the Cortana button, it just crashes the phone now. So if I hold down search to try Cortana, I was really wanting to see how good Cortana was, it just crashes my phone. So something's gone wrong. I'm not sure whether it's a customized phone that's got some US operator settings and it doesn't like the fact that it's in New Zealand or something, but that sort of thing for me hasn't worked well at all. So my only experience, but I may be an outlier, but I mean, Apple is just the master of that. You can have a phone that's four generations old and it'll run a new update. So
But we all have also had the issues where Apple releases an update that doesn't quite brick your phone or your iPad, but can we have seen those updates that actually, should they have released it for this phone? Because it's now made my phone or my device so slow and cumbersome that actually I wish I hadn't installed it. And, by the way, now it's so slow and cumbersome, I better go and buy a new one, which sort of works in their favour in terms of maybe some new sales.
That's true. I've got a couple of Generation 1 iPads and they're virtually bricked because they're so horrendously slow. I wish I could just roll them back and give them to my mum and dad as kind of newspaper readers kind of thing, and
exactly. So I think every manufacturer or every tech company will make their little sort of mistakes along the way for one, you know, for one reason or another. Then they're not all perfect, although we wish they all would be. But the fact that we've got, you know, multiple players that are pushing in different directions, again, you know, that's what's helping to drive some of the innovation.
You know, I like the way the look. Same with what you agree as well, CB, about the look of it. They're doing something different as well. The interface, the tiles, it looks cool. But for me, I just wouldn't get into the Windows Phone.
There's no apps, which is a big problem, but there's certain things I love about the Windows Phone. Like, for example, when you set it up, you're just prompted for your Facebook credentials, and then you can have your Facebook pictures on your lock screen rotating around and all that kind of thing. And there's a bunch of things that I really, you know, really like more than, you know, I wish that I could have that function on my iPhone, so that every time I open up my iPhone, it's a new picture from a recent thing from my friend, so I can sort of interact with it. But
I don't think they've got so much of an app issue now. I mean, there are still some things that aren't available, but most of the major ones are there. What I find is it's more the sort of some of the sort of smaller, you know, apps or banking, local apps like banking and so on. In New Zealand, you know, we're talking about ASB and banking before. Yeah, they've got their Windows Phone app, but you know, none of the others have here. So you've got to go through and use the web interface instead, which is always a slightly lesser experience. But you know, a lot of the other sort of, you know, key apps, Instagrams and so on, are on there and are pretty good. But that's certainly one of the considerations. Now, Heartbleed. This has been in the media over the last week. It's not often that we sort of get big, you know, security related tech stories that land in the mainstream media, but we have in the last few days.
I've got quite a lot of personal experience with this because, as I say, we host maybe a quarter of New Zealand's websites, so 25,000 sites. And so we went through with a scanner, Heartbleed scanner, and scanned all of our sites, and are notifying customers. We patched all of our own servers pretty much as soon as it came out. So all of our shared hosting, where
excellent,
there's multi-tenant stuff, is completely patched.
Yep.
But we've got a number of dedicated server customers and, you know, VMware virtual machines that we can't really touch because the customers are responsible for the OS. And so out of 25,000 sites, I think we had about 10% of those running SSL. And then globally, the proportion of SSL sites that were vulnerable was about 17%. So that left us with about 800 customers. And then the ones that actually were vulnerable, we worked out at about 425, and half of those have since patched. So we've now got about 170 customers left, which is not too bad for 25,000 websites. But
no, that's moving through it pretty quickly, isn't it?
Our tech guys actually, did a bit of reading and worked out how the exploit worked, and effectively, Heartbleed allows you to go and grab a 64 kilobyte section of server memory, off the net. So if you keep on trying a server, you can then go and get the server's private keys, and you can go and get a whole lot of data. So it's Heartbleed's, you know, a lot of people think it's just about intercepting SSL, and you have to have a man in the middle, and he has to have a sniffer, and that's not very likely. It's actually an extremely serious flaw
that
the passwords off the server.
It basically lets you just steal, I guess, random data off a server, doesn't it?
If you try hard enough and you try enough times, you will be able to basically get in, get all the passwords, that kind of thing. So, everyone in the world should treat their passwords to the major sites as compromised. And, so we set up a test lab and compromised a server and basically got root access, all the passwords off it, completely, devastating, absolutely devastating hack. And obviously the NSA has probably had it for...
Is this one of the ways, like with the recent Snapchat hacking, would that be one of the ways of...
I don't think Snapchat had anything to do with the Heartbleed attack. But
it's a straight hack.
Yeah, I mean, Heartbleed's probably the most serious security flaw that's ever been discovered in the internet since it went mainstream.
It's huge, isn't it? And the fact that it can just feed out confidential data at people that are, visiting these websites and so on. Beyond comprehension.
Would you do your patches in that then for it?
Being a large scale hosting company, we're patching continuously all the time. We've got hundreds of servers that we manage, thousands of servers in our shared hosting infrastructure, so we're managing them all the time. But once Heartbleed came out, we had to work out, because some of the older versions actually weren't susceptible and some of the newer versions, so it was sort of a mid-tier version.
Yep.
So what we did is we just ran a scanner across all of our IP addresses, and we didn't actually have to check all of our sites. We just had to check the server running on each IP, because obviously one server can host a lot of sites.
Okay.
And if a server was susceptible, then it was, you know, all the sites on that server were susceptible, so we patched that pretty quickly.
Yeah, and there's some good tools online. LastPass have got set up a checker, but there's a whole range of tools online that you can use, and you know, just check, and you can, for instance, you can, if you're not sure about a particular website you might visit, you can use that to check whether they're okay or not. Now, the interesting thing about this is, because it's OpenSSL is a, you know, it's open source software, it's affected a huge number of websites, hasn't it? I mean, as you were saying, you know, a fair proportion of websites around the world. Those with Microsoft servers, because they're using Microsoft SSL technologies and so on, haven't been impacted, but it really is a pretty big percentage.
And not
of
all
the,
open
of the
SSL
net.
Sites were sort of affected either. So it's about 17% of SSL sites. And the ironic thing is that it means that a number of sites that are susceptible are actually less secure than the non-HTTPS, because you know, it's good to have HTTPS on, but Heartbleed actually makes the server more susceptible and easier to hack than just not having any, you know, security at all.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is, it'd be an interesting topic to have, you know, have some more discussion in around open source, because basically, you know, there's been some discussion already with, and I can't remember his name now, but the programmer that was responsible for actually, you know, producing this particular you know, piece of code, and, you know, he admitted that it was a mistake, and then there was somebody else who checked the code, they missed it as well. Yet maybe that, does this highlight, CB, maybe some flaws in the open source model, where, you know, there needs to be a little bit more stringent testing, or particularly around these security you know, types of pieces? I know within, you know, the big software, you know, firms, Microsoft, with their SDLC, the secure development lifecycle, and, you know, Apple and others, you know, put a lot of resource into getting things secure from the get-go. But yeah, it's maybe a little bit harder to guarantee in the open
think
source
it would be,
world.
I definitely think it would be very wrong to say that it's a flaw in the open source model, because the advantage about the open source model is you can have a huge number of people out there looking at things. And, you know, if you have a closed ecosystem like Microsoft or Apple and there's a flaw, well, then no one can discover it, because no one can actually get in to have a look at it. So the end result of Heartbleed is that it's going to be fixed. It probably won't happen again. People will be more aware of it. Maybe we need to go and see whether the guys got a super yacht or something from the NSA for letting it slip through.
Yeah,
finances.
Well, I guess, and that's one of the considerations, isn't it? Is that with open source, with you know, anyone being able to contribute, you know, there could be that risk that somebody with nefarious sort of purposes inserts or, you know, produces some code that does leave something like this wide open for a period of time. And you can just imagine if a bad organisation had known about this and was utilising it, and there's certainly been some, you know, rumours around whoever.
But again, I think if you were a conspiracy theorist programmer, this the comfort that you can get around open source is you can go and look at the code, you can go and compile it, and then you can say, well, I'm comfortable that the NSA hasn't diddled with this. But if it's a closed ecosystem and you're just given some code by Microsoft or Apple or whoever, you don't know what's in there, you can't check it, so you don't know whether your phone and your laptop and everything is spying on you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
It's a good point, but on the flip side, most of us aren't developers and coders, and we're not going to go and look through the source code to work out whether something's secure. So I guess it depends whether you trust the crowd to get it right, or whether you trust a corporation to get it right, or whether you just don't trust any of them, which is probably more the camp I would sit in. Is, you know, you can't have absolute confidence that these things are going to be safe and secure, can you?
Well, I think, I think we're all aware now that you send any text message, you make any phone call, someone out there, someone knows about it. So, you know, you just need to have that awareness in mind.
Mm. Okay, now a couple of things before we finish up. Amazon Fire TV landed here mid last week from the US. Nice little set top box. Now I am in a little bit of trouble today because I've left it at home attached to my TV. I managed to grab the remote.
Wow!
So we're able to pass the remote around.
What a remote!
But the cool thing that sort of stood out for me, because you know I've tried most of the various sort of set top boxes that have come through, and the Rokus and you know PlayStation, Xbox, and so on. There's lots of different ways of playing your Netflix content and Hulu Plus and so on. Amazon have got their Prime subscription, and most of these things are US services, so you know it takes a bit of a commitment, you know, for most people to actually try them out. So you know, to get this, I had to order it, get it forwarded to a US address, forwarded on, because Amazon don't sell it into the New Zealand market, and the primary service that runs on it from their perspective, you know, is the Amazon Prime video service and so on for you know, for their, I guess, is their Netflix competitor, and you can also buy, you know, latest movies and TV programs to watch and so on as well. But in, you know, in terms of accessing it, yeah, there's some hoops to jump through, but for me, I think it's really good. But its main feature is around this voice control, and you've got the button on it. CB's just pressing it there, where you can, you know, you can talk into it, and he's waving it around and modelling it for everyone. He just wishes there was a camera here.
Should be a hair model.
But that worked really well. But it's limited purely to Amazon's video service. So whereas I know I'll pick the Xbox as an example, which has got a universal search. So on the Xbox, you can go in there and you know, type in or even use your voice control or whatever to pick a bit of content, and you know, there you prefix it with Bing for its search, and then you Bing Lord of the Rings, for instance, and then it comes up with all the content, and then it tells you how you can get it, whether it's Netflix, whether it's through Amazon, whether it's through Xbox videos and so on. So that to me is a really good experience, but the Amazon experience I think has got a way to go, because it, when you use that voice control, and it works really well, even with my non-American accent, being aimed at the US market, you know, the results were mostly good, but it's only looking to its own services, not looking out to what's on Netflix and all the other services. So I guess a little bit more development to go.
I guess all of the, you know, Microsoft, Apple, and Google and Amazon are all trying to silo us to a degree, though. So, you know, I, as I said before, I have a US iTunes account on my Apple TV, and I'm siloed. I can only access the iTunes services, but I'm super, super happy with the fact that I can access just about any movie ever made, and all the TV shows my girlfriend wants to watch are in there, and so we have a great experience. And so someone on the Amazon service probably is going to have a reasonable experience too with all that content. But I mean, it's going to be frustrating for people if you buy a movie on Amazon and then you want to watch it on your Apple TV, and you can't sort of move your content libraries around. You're going to have, you know, one device for this and that. So I don't know how that's going to play out long term, but it's frustrating that if you buy a piece of content on, you know, iBooks, then you've got to go and buy it again, and you know, Kindle, and you know,
sure. And one of the things was, I mean, you'll see it there on the cover of the box is there's a House of Cards picture was on the cover for it. And so if you go in and do a search for House of Cards using that voice control, it's not giving you House of Cards, which is the, you know, on Netflix for free, even if you've got a Netflix subscription. It's going to find it within Amazon's catalogue, and you're going to pay per episode for it.
Mm.
So, you know, that's a little bit of a degraded, you know, experience to you know, some of the other innovation we're seeing with these sort of, you know, combined searches. Now, the other product that we didn't, I think we might have touched on very briefly last week, is that Google have had Google TV for a while. Hasn't really taken off, but very soon after Amazon announcing the Fire TV, Google announced Android TV. And interestingly, the Fire TV is based on Android in the background. You can actually install Android apps. You can go through and sort of push those in there, and that's partly how they're able to launch with a bunch of games as well as this standard set-top box stuff.
Okay.
But we've got you know, Google pushing ahead now with Android TV. So that whole sort of little you know, set-top box space just is you know, continuing to heat up, which is not a bad thing.
How much did the Amazon set you back?
So it's $99 US, you know, ex-tax and so on. It's got a quad-core processor. Yeah. You know, it's more than capable of handling the task. So yeah, it's pretty good. Now, one other. Oh no! Actually, I think we're out of time, so we will save our further discussions for the next episode. So yeah, that's us. Thank you, everybody, for listening in.
Thank you, Paul,
CB, and Walls. CB. Thank you for joining us. Now, CB, where do we track you down online? You're an avid Twitter guy.
Yep, love my Twitter. So my name's spelled SEEBY. So I'm at CB on Twitter.
Excellent.
And find me on LinkedIn and Facebook and every other thing under the planet, but yeah, Twitter's my main home. So yeah, at CBSEEBY.
Excellent. And your company, you've got Voyager as the main brand, but you've got a couple of other associated sort of companies. How does that
So after I sold Orcon, I sort of retired for a few years, got into commercial property, and then I really missed the internet industry and the tech scene, and so I started Voyager. Voyager used to be one of New Zealand's first biggest ISPs, but they got bought by MCI WorldCom, who went bankrupt and so sort of disappeared for a while. So my Voyager is not the same Voyager, but doing the same sort of thing. I think it's a great name for an ISP. And so how I got back into the industry was doing a roll-up of a bunch of New Zealand's hosting and domain name companies. So I own about 10 different web hosting and domain name brands. But then over the last year, we've got back into broadband and, you know, voice and Cloud PBX and a bunch of other services, and eventually we'll roll all the brands together, and then emerges this awesome super company that hopefully you'll all love.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, that sounds exciting. And Wal, we can track you down on Twitter.
Yeah, you can at Wal Reed. I'm on there, and also you can check out my big passion is entertainment. So the New Zealand Entertainment Podcast. So plug on Facebook, NZ Entertainment Podcast. No spaces. Just on Facebook, and check out the next episode is coming out soon with Jamie Bowen, comedian Jamie Bowen.
Oh, cool.
And with Sheena and Alex, who are running open mic night.
Excellent. Yeah, there's always interesting stuff there, always getting me exposed to new things happening within sort of music and video world and so on.
Well, that's good. I've just got a few tips from you and CB just there from the next show, so it's kind of handy dropping in.
Excellent, cool. Excellent. All right, well, hey, thanks everyone for listening in. We'll catch you all on the next show. See ya.
See you later.